Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, April 14th, 2014. We open with an instrumental ditty from way back in 1968. It debuted on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. It's called Classical Gas by Mason Williams. And once again, it is gas, chemical weapons, leading our News and Comment podcast today. There is a report that chemical weapons were used again last week in Syria. And the U.S. media has reported it, as our officials are trying to gain more information about an attack that occurred in a village north of Damascus that so far is described by American authorities as unsubstantiated. The town is Kfar Zeita, an opposition-held village in Hama province. And while many of us are disturbed that this war continues and that we still haven't sorted out what occurred last August in Ghouta, the Damascus suburb, my focus is on the reporting on these events by the corporate media in this country. Because last week we detailed for you and released our in-depth interview with journalist Robert Perry about the new investigation, the new advances in the story by Seymour Hersh, published in the London Review of Books about a week ago. And what Hersh reported is that the U.S. was running a so-called rat line, moving weapons from Libya, which, by the way, just saw the resignation of its second prime minister in 2 months. But we were collecting weapons from the Gaddafi cache, holding them in Benghazi, and then shipping them off via Turkey into Syria. And Cy Hirsch's reporting, while it was not definitive, strongly suggested that the evidence is clear, that it wasn't the Syrian government and the military of the brutal dictator Bashar al-Assad who initiated the chemical weapons attack in Ghouta last August, and that it was most likely the al-Nusra Front, this group that we say is aligned with al-Qaeda, and it appears they are increasingly desperate. The allegation is that last week's chemical weapons attack was a chlorine gas, reportedly killing two and wounding many more. And what I find just amazing is that the corporate media in this country is willing to simply take the press releases from the White House and UN Ambassador Samantha Power, and then they have recapitulated that our government believes that it was the Syrian military that used chemical weapons last August and that the Assad government objects to that. No reference of Seymour Hersh. Nothing about the involvement of Turkey behind the scenes. Nothing about the report from Cy Hersh that Turkey is likely have been the source of the ingredients for the crude chemicals were to sarin last August, chlorine reportedly last week. And so it's just quite frustrating. And the reason I led with this story today is to invite my listeners to review other media critically. And when you see the story about Syria, look at the way they portray the events of last year. Once again, the bias tilts toward believing John Kerry and Barack Obama in their evidence-free assertions that it was the Syrians who lobbed the chemical weapons. And Bashar al-Assad himself is feeling pretty optimistic these days. He says that the civil war is turning in the government's favor after more than 3 years, roughly 150,000 or more killed. Syria's army has made a series of advances in recent months, overrunning opposition bastions near the Lebanese border and in Homs, the central province. Syrian warplanes on Sunday launched fresh strikes on a rebel stronghold in the edge of Damascus, some using highly destructive barrel bomb attacks. And, of course, Assad characterizes all this as a war against terrorism. He's using the same framing and language that's used by Putin against Ukrainians, that's used by the United States against just about any enemy we want to name. And at the bottom of it all, people are dying in large numbers, and there is no end in sight. Meanwhile, those attacks in Ukraine over the weekend have led to the acting government in Kiev calling on the United Nations to send peacekeeping troops. And you look at this and you say, what? Or if you're cruder, you say, WTF? Because the only way that the United Nations could commit forces to Ukraine in their blue helmets on a peacekeeping basis is if it's approved by the UN Security Council. Duh. Who's got a veto vote as a permanent member of the Security Council? That would be Russia. And so this is a flare sent into the air that just shows true desperation. And over the weekend in eastern Ukraine, there were a series of incidents where Ukrainian soldiers tried to take back a government building, tried to dismantle a checkpoint. But the pro-Russian thugs, you would call them, if you're looking at it from the perspective of Kiev, they have now occupied administrative buildings or police stations in 9 towns. They build barricades, seize and disperse police weapons to the crowds. And one effort to take down one of their checkpoints resulted in the death of a Ukrainian soldier, and those troops quickly withdrew. And so, while Ukraine keeps sending out desperate messages that Russia wants to annex more than just Crimea, it doesn't seem like they're playing with a full deck there. Like, they understand the realities of the situation. And now we've got threats from Putin to cut off natural gas supplies to Ukraine and Europe until Ukraine pays its full bill. They had been offered a discount, but that's been withdrawn. And so what we're going to see is that the money offered by the United States and the World Bank and International Monetary Fund will most likely go directly to Putin to pay the gas bill. And as I've said many times, the U.S. and NATO should recognize that we don't have a hand to play here. And you can call it deplorable that Putin is a bad guy who is muscularly expanding his turf. But the empty threats coming from the U.S. only make us seem weaker. And the U.N.'s not going in there, we're not going in there. And so the rest will be left to Vladimir to decide. Grant Gibson, Cheryl Fleming, Wendy Gebauer, Rich Attlee, they're all people who decided to subscribe and support my program. Wendy Gebauer just renewed her annual subscription. And I want to thank each and every one of you who has decided to help fund this little enterprise. And as I've candidly told you, for whatever reason, lately we've lost quite a few subscribers. And I don't know if they just didn't think they were listening enough to make it worth it. Maybe I said something that offended them. That's always entirely possible. I understand that. But if you value what we're doing here, and if you see this as an important alternative to the corporate news outlets that feed you so much propaganda, well, I'd like you to put your money where that mouth is, okay? Go on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the link under my picture that says sign up. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. The best deals are $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers in the U.S. get a copy of this rock and roll CD. A lot of great tunes on here by John Dist. And there's an interview with him posted at peterbcollins.com if you want to find out more about him and his music. The CD is called Red Flag. That's your bonus gift along with a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans. And all you got to do is sign up for a new annual subscription at peterbcollins.com. Well, as you know, I've been a sharp critic of the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, since the day it opened, and of the kangaroo courts, the so-called military tribunals, that are used to put on political show trials. And the latest one is bogged down yet again, and the reason is misconduct by our government. And when you lay out the litany of abuses of ordinary military justice or civilian justice, as the United States defines it, these trials at Guantanamo are a really sick, twisted joke. The latest is that the FBI has been accused of spying on defense attorneys. At issue is a letter or a manifesto that was written by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and found its way into the media a few months ago. So the FBI started investigating people on the legal teams at Guantanamo and allegedly tried to turn a member of one defendant's law team into a secret informant. They wanted to flip that person. Now, this is on the heels of the monitoring of communications that were supposed to be confidential between attorney and client, and other obvious abuses of the basic procedures and safeguards built into a justice system that is supposed to be fair and transparent. And when you include the secret evidence, evidence derived from torture, I mean, there's no way that whatever trials finally occur at Guantanamo will ever have the stature of the post-World War II Nuremberg trials. And so this latest skirmish has caused the trial judge, James Pohl, to consider motions, but his boss is saying, Mark Martins is saying, continue. I want you to proceed. Well, most observers believe that the earliest an actual trial of KSM and the four others accused of plotting the 9/11 crimes will not occur before 2016. And justice delayed is justice denied, but injustice delayed, unfortunately, is just more injustice. Here's another knock on the FBI. According to the Washington Post, which reported this last Friday, the FBI had agents secretly working with American troops in Iraq and Afghanistan in hundreds of operations. Now, I had no idea we were deploying FBI agents to war zones, putting them in the line of fire. The FBI worked with the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC. And JSOC took advantage of the agency's ability to utilize digital media to identify suspects. That sounds like facial recognition software to me. I thought that's what the NSA did. So it's a little confusing here. And we know that while there are no reports of FBI agents being killed in the line of fire, there apparently were strong concerns expressed by FBI agents who were deployed in this manner. Here's another issue of some confusion. I've commented on this recently, that a year ago in May, President Obama announced, and this also came from John Brennan when he moved over from the White House drone czar back to the CIA, where he'd been for 25 years previously, as the director of Central Intelligence. And both represented that we were going to end the CIA's control of drone missions, particularly in war zones, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Yemen. Well, there's an excellent report in Britain's Guardian newspaper today based on a film called Drone, a documentary, scheduled to be released tomorrow. I'm not familiar with the filmmaker. I'm not sure if it's a he or she. A Tonje, T-O-N-J-E, Hessen-Schei, spelled S-C-H-E-I. This documentary drone has been in the works for over 3 years. And one of the things that is revealed is that the idea that there is any separation between the CIA and the military in drone operations is bullshit. And what we're learning is that the CIA directs the Air Force in the deployment of drones for reconnaissance and for missile strikes. A former U.S. Predator operator named Brandon Bryant told the documentarians that he decided to speak up because after he heard last year that they wanted to transfer control of the CIA's secret drone program to the military, he said this is disingenuous. It's widely known in military circles that the U.S. Air Force was already involved. Quote, "There is a lie hidden within that truth. And the lie is that it's always been the Air Force that has flown those missions. The CIA might be the customer, but the Air Force has always flown it. A CIA label is just an excuse to not have to give up any information. That is all it has ever been." And I've mentioned this before, that the distinction about exactly who controls these drones is not that important to me. They're used in a manner where, particularly in Yemen, we strike at will at a country where we have no authority to do so. We don't have any treaty obligations. It hasn't been approved by our Congress. And so, why they felt the need to mislead the American public and the world on this is beyond me. Here's another quote from Bryant. "Everyone talks about CIA over Pakistan, CIA double tap, CIA over Yemen, CIA over Somalia. But I don't believe that they deserve the entirety of all that credit for the drone program. They might drive the missions, they might say that these are the objectives, accomplish it, but they don't fly it. And most of the flights, at least that they're talking about here, come out of the Creech Air Force Base outside Las Vegas, where there are several units at this one base, and one is super secret. And it's fascinating to see the curtain pulled back just a little bit. There is the 732nd Operations Group and four squadrons under it on the roster, including the 17th Reconnaissance Squadron, and the 17th is the one that is in its own kind of segregated area at the Creech Air Force Base. And at Creech, the report is that there are about 300 aircrew operating around 35 Predator drones from Creech during any 24-hour period. Now, a few clicks up the road from Creech, there was a showdown over the weekend. And the U.S. government caved in, gave up, and walked away from a showdown with Cliven Bundy, the Mormon patriarch of 14 who claims that he and his family, his ancestors, have lived on this land, and they don't recognize the federal government's control. Now, about 85% of Nevada is controlled by the federal government, either the military installations like Area 51 and Creech and other Air Force bases, and public lands that are controlled by the Bureau of Land Management. The issue is that for 20 years, Bundy has been running his cattle onto public lands, and there is an endangered species that has caused them to restrict grazing in this particular area. So Bundy claims that the federal government has no jurisdiction over him. Quote, "We definitely don't recognize the BLM director's jurisdiction or authority, his arresting power or policing power in any way." So this guy Bundy got a bunch of supporters. They all came out like cowboys on their horses, heavily armed, like a spaghetti western. And there was this confrontation with BLM authorities on Saturday. And it ended with the BLM backing down, releasing all of Bundy's cattle that they had quarantined, and basically saying that they were not going to have a shooting match with this heavily armed farmer. And I commend the government, and I take it that this is Eric Holder's decision. The attorney general typically is in charge of these kinds of operations. And as a sharp critic of Eric Holder, I'd say he got this one right. They're going to take some hits in the right-wing media because this guy, Bundy, will be permitted to gloat. And Tea Party types will use this as a wedge. But the government did the right thing. We don't need another Ruby Ridge or Waco. And, you know, I mentioned the proximity to the Creech Air Force Base. They could have flown some drones up there. And I'm pleased that they did not. The Washington Post ran a very interesting article in the Sunday edition, I think, about the lobbying muscle of a company called Google in Washington, D.C. Now, I want to direct you to my recent podcast interviews with Yasha Levine of Pando, the online publication Pando. Both interviews were released at BoilingFrogsPost.com in the last month. And Levine has done great work at Pando, exposing Google's close work with the government, including the military and intelligence sectors. And, for example, Google Earth was developed under a contract with the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Well, now Google is working to become a master of Washington influence, as the headline in the Washington Post reads. And they have upgraded their lobby shop there with a whole bunch of Republicans, including Susan Molinari, who was a member of the House from suburban New York City. And they are busy cozying up to the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, and George Mason University. And Google spreads cash around, and they also give away credits for Google AdWords. These are used as contributions to foundations. Probably Google gets a tax write-off for it. But the bottom line is that Google has a lot of friendly people in Washington ready to do its bidding, to show up at a conference at George Mason University. And one of the things the article details is how Google helped kill SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act. Now, I thought that was a bad bill, and I'm glad that it was killed. But the dirty plays, the dark groups that Google joined forces with, include the Heritage Foundation and its offshoot, Heritage Action. And so we have a situation now where in Washington, Google has wired the nerve centers. And the article, I think, is fascinating, particularly coming from an approval-seeking organ like the Washington Post. And this is Jeff Bezos, the Amazon billionaire's Washington Post now. So it's interesting to see them take on an issue like that. We've been talking a little bit about the heartbleed bug. I'm not sure if it's called a full-blown virus, but it is a defect in encryption software that has affected many of the e-business, the online transactions, and their security. And we're told that the target hackers didn't get in this way. But what is fascinating to me, in the follow-up coverage over the weekend, we learned that the NSA has hackers who work to develop information about flaws, vulnerabilities in all kinds of internet systems. And then they exploit those vulnerabilities for intelligence gathering purposes. Are they all legal? Well, I don't know, but if I had to guess, I'd say hell no. So the issue is when the NSA discovers a defect like this, what do they do about it? Do they notify the companies in an effort to protect their customers? Well, back in January, after his hand-picked Commission of Friends reviewed the NSA and had their 40-plus recommendations, one thing that Obama did was it appeared that he was tightening up the rules on the NSA. But according to the New York Times, Obama carved a broad exception for a clear national security or law enforcement need, a loophole that is likely to allow the NSA to continue to exploit security flaws, both to crack encryption on the internet and to design cyber weapons. And so it underscores that Obama is an enabler of the worst abuses of the NSA. He also, of course, declares that the NSA hasn't abused its power, and we know that's not true. The other thing I wanted to mention about the NSA is that people who watch carefully have noted that Glenn Greenwald hasn't published in 11 days, even though he recently promised that there is much more in the pipeline. And the critics of his new website, First Look, are also wondering if there's a relaunch underway or something like that. So I just wanted to mention that to you for your consideration. Also on the web this morning, I woke up and read a post by Roger Shuler, our friend who was recently released from the jail in Shelby County, Alabama, on phony contempt charges. And he served 5 months until his wife pulled down a series of articles that Roger had posted that exposed hypocrisy and sexual affairs of leading Republicans in the state of Alabama. And to his shock, Roger Shuler was notified on Saturday that somebody took his articles and posted them on a copycat website. They just took the legal schnauzer name and added the letter A at the end to form a nonsense term, legalschnauzera.blogspot.com. And now, Roger Shuler is in the bizarre position of being on the same side as Rob Riley, the man who brought the defamation case that was railroaded through in a process that can only be called Kafkaesque. Now, Riley and Shuler are both trying to find out who this is who's taken Shuler's articles about Riley and put them back up on the internets. And Shuler says that he wants to cooperate with authorities. He doesn't know anything about this. He didn't cause it to happen. I'll tell you, things are really strange down there in Bama. Tomorrow's tax day, and your humble host is feverishly working to finish filling out all those damn forms. Got to take care of California next. Jerry, don't expect a lot, dude. Wasn't a big year last year. Interesting full-page ad in Sunday's New York Times, a plea to Pope Francis. And there's a lot of text here. It was written by Carl Siciliano, the executive director of the Ali Forney Center in New York. And the Ali Forney Center helps support LGBT persons who are homeless. And according to Carl Siciliano, many of those people are homeless because their religious parents have disowned them. And in part in this ad, he writes, "The Roman Catholic Church is the largest, most influential Christian organization in the world. By teaching that homosexual conduct is a sin and that the homosexual orientation is disordered, it influences countless parents and families and societies across the globe to reject their children. In the name of these children, in the light and in light of the love and compassion at the heart of the message of Jesus, I ask that you end this teaching. Jesus Christ is never recorded as having said a word in judgment or condemnation of homosexuality or of LGBT people. He spoke of a loving, compassionate God and commanded his followers to act with love and compassion. Jesus spoke of God as a loving parent who would never abandon his children." Well, it's a very powerful piece. And it's time during the Holy Week in the Roman Catholic calendar, leading up to Good Friday, which commemorates the crucifixion, and Easter Sunday, which commemorates the resurrection. And I would love to see Pope Francis honor the request of this full-page ad. But I'm sorry to say it ain't going to happen. Pope Francis has a different tone but not a different theology. And I don't think that he will break with the darkest traditions of the Roman Catholic Church anytime soon. And finally today, I want to thank Andy Draw, a listener and frequent correspondent here, for urging me to talk up the Better Off budget. Now, last week, the House passed another meaningless Paul Ryan budget, full of hate, hateful cuts, mean-spirited efforts to balance the budget. But Andy wanted to point out that the Progressive Caucus of the House, chaired by Raul Grijalva, has passed what is called the Better Off budget, which projects to create more than 8 million jobs by 2017, would reduce the deficit by $4 trillion over 10 years, would bring back the Clinton-era tax regime, meaning that it would roll back the Bush tax cuts. It would fund long-term unemployment insurance, $820 billion in infrastructure spending, $95 billion in state aid to rehire state, county, and municipal employees who've been laid off, and $100 billion for public works and education. And it would cut almost $1 trillion in defense spending over 10 years. So it certainly mirrors my values. And he noted that here in Northern California, Democratic Congress members Jackie Speier, Barbara Lee, Sam Farr, Mike Honda, Jared Huffman, Lois Matsui, Doris Matsui, and George Miller all voted for it. Let's name the people around here who didn't. Ami Berra, an alleged progressive from Sacramento, Anna Eshoo of Silicon Valley, Zoe Lofgren, Jerry McNerney, Eric Swalwell, and Mike Thompson. Thanks for paying attention there, Andy, and bringing it to my attention, too. I really do appreciate that. And thank you all for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you are invited to share with absolutely everyone. And as Roy Rogers rides Trigger off into the sunset, I invite you to like me on Facebook, please.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.